Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. We've got a lot to talk about in the battle space of the war for the free world at the moment, and we're going to jump right into it with our first guest, Vice Admiral Robert Monroe, United States Navy retired, one of the most distinguished military officers I've had the pleasure of knowing, and a man who I particularly value as a resource on matters involving nuclear forces. Credentials Bob Monroe brings to this topic are too many to mention at the moment. Let me simply say he ran a tremendously important organization known as the Defense Nuclear Agency, as well as was responsible for development of Navy weapon systems back in his career in uniform. And there's a lot to talk about, Bob, in this space. And let me just mention a couple of things that are on my mind, and hopefully we can cover them at least briefly in this brief segment with you. We have people who should know better, including Henry Kissinger, promoting an idea they call Global Zero, ridding the entire world of nuclear weapons. We have President Obama talking about unilateral reductions in our nuclear forces of perhaps as much as 80%, according to one of his subordinates, Rose Gottmuller, doing it through executive action, unilaterally, in other words. We have a study coming out of the National Academy of Sciences at the end of next week in which they will be promoting a treaty that you and I have fought many times in the past, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which basically would preclude us from ever being able to test our nuclear weapons in the future. And then we have a whole host of problems around the world with people who are evidencing no interest at all in reducing, let alone getting rid of their nuclear weapons. In fact, they're building up. Let's talk first about that threat, Bob Monroe, as you see it, as it bears on the advisability of the United States eliminating its nuclear forces, especially unilaterally.
Thank you, Frank. Delighted to be here. It's ironic that President Obama is leading us into a world of nuclear weakness. At the same time, the nuclear threat is increasing apace all over the world. Russia is designing and building new weapons and has a military strategy that is focused on early use of nuclear weapons in almost any conflict, large or small. We have China that's in the midst of a strategic modernization, both quality and quantity, and vastly increasing the numbers of nuclear weapons that they are able to target, with which they're able to target the United States. North Korea is threatening every day with some nuclear threat or other. Right now they're planning a nuclear launch of a long-range missile. They're continually and rapidly increasing the range of their ICBMs, which will soon reach the United States. Iran is on the verge of nuclear weapons, and the world has done nothing about that but wring its hands for 20 years, and they're right on the edge now, and of course that would turn into a nuclear catastrophe in the Mideast, as they deliberately threaten to totally destroy Israel when they get nuclear weapons. We got Pakistan and India poised and confronting each other. And the biggest threat of all is not these individual states, but proliferation, which threatens to be a cascade. And beyond that, of course, terrorists, rogue states, and proxies all trying to get nuclear weapons.
Let's talk a little bit about the condition of our deterrent to these threats at the moment. Vice Admiral Bob Monroe, again, you've spent much of your career in uniform and since leaving military service, trying to think through and ensure that the deterrent we have is as safe and reliable and as effective as we can make it. Is it that today?
It is absolutely not. We're approaching disastrous levels of nuclear readiness. For 65 years, since the dawn of the nuclear era, 12 presidents of both parties have cast nuclear weapons as the principal foundation of our national security. They ended World War II. They ended the Cold War. They kept us safe from attack. They avoided dozens of other wars. Now comes President Obama in 2009, casts nuclear weapons as an unmitigated evil, which must be eliminated. And the way to eliminate them and lead to his vision of a world without nuclear weapons, in his view, is to for the U.S. to lead the way. So he establishes a national goal of ridding the world of nuclear weapons and follows this up with active programs in every way to diminish and degrade and reduce the U.S. nuclear weapons capability. He reduces the numbers of nuclear weapons, cancels multiple nuclear weapons programs, makes direct cutbacks in nuclear weapon budgets, has engaged us for years in meaningless treaties like New START with Russia, which has wasted time on the preparations we should be making, and in
a very serious way reduced our arsenal beyond where I would argue it should be. Admiral Monroe, let me just ask you quickly, because we're going to run out of time here. My view of this is that it's perhaps the best kept secret in Washington. And for that matter, around the country, that our nuclear deterrent has been allowed to atrophy to the degree it has, that not only are the numbers dramatically reduced from what they were back in the height of the Cold War, most especially, but that the age of these weapons is unbelievably high, that they have not been tested in over 20 years now in a realistic underground test program. That the designs that we have in these weapons are nowhere near as safe and reliable as we could make them, let alone as effective in deterring the sorts of adversaries that you described a moment ago. What should we be doing at this moment that we are not in order to remedy this situation?
I think I can give it to you in about 7 points. First, we need a totally new nuclear weapons deterrent strategy. Our strategy hasn't adapted one whit today from what it was during the Cold War, which was massive, high-yield nuclear weapon exchanges or attempts to deter exchanges with the Soviet Union.
Number two.
We should be establishing requirements for new nuclear weapons, such as high-security weapons that can't be used against us, low-yield weapons, earth-penetrating weapons, reduced residual radiation weapons. These are all new nuclear technology. They all require testing. We should be doing underground testing, research and development in advanced concepts for certification of their new designs, for verification of the old existing weapons that will still have to carry us through 20 years, the survivability of the DOD's tests of the survivability of all of their conventional weapons against nuclear effects. We should complete with high priority the modernization of our nuclear weapons infrastructure, the labs, the testing organizations, and the production organizations. They're essentially, they haven't been used for 2 decades, and that's a lifetime in the nuclear weapons. Our scientists, designers, engineers, test teams, production teams haven't put their hand to the mission for all that time, and we hardly have anybody left that has designed a weapon and tested it. Our next generation delivery systems, submarine launch, ballistic missiles, ICBMs, bombers, cruise missiles, next generation systems are being delayed year by year by year in the Department of Defense.
Admiral, we're going to have to wrap at that. Your litany is impressive, staggering, really, of the sorts of things that need to be done. It's a really indictment of this administration and perhaps some of the previous ones, for that matter, that not more of this has been accomplished. We look forward to visiting with you a lot about this and our other colleagues to ensure that the public understands what's going on here, what's at stake, and that we actually take seriously the need for nuclear deterrence today as much as ever, perhaps more than in the past. Admiral Bob Monroe, thank you so much for your leadership and for spending some time with us on this. We look forward to, as I said, talking with you again soon. Next up, Fred Grandy goes inside the cloakroom with Congressman Joe Walsh about faith under fire. straight ahead.
Your comments or questions for us at 1-800-332-7131.
Do you want the big picture on national security and foreign policy? Find out what Ronald Reagan meant by peace through strength at securefreedomradio.org. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. First line of defense in the war of ideas. Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy in the cloakroom today. Very pleased to welcome a new member of Congress, but somebody who is already making a very strong impression on Capitol Hill. He is Congressman Joe Walsh, Republican from the 8th District of Illinois. I think it's fair to say a Tea Party favorite, a member of the Homeland Security Committee, a member of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, the Small Business Committee, but most importantly, to friends of the Center for Security Policy, Congressman Walsh was one of the attendees at our Faith Under Fire conference on Saturday, March 10th, that brought together a lot of persecuted minorities, Coptic Christians and others, in the Chicago area. And Congressman, as I'm sure you remember, you had a lot of friends in that room. So let me get your impressions of what you heard at that conference.
It's interesting, Fred. It was an honor to be there, and it was great to be there with you. I was both equally moved and equally frustrated. I have read so much about what's going on in the Middle East, especially when it comes to persecution of Christians throughout that area. But it's always so powerful to literally be in the presence of folks who have experienced it themselves and who know of people who've experienced it. I found it incredibly moving. And as a freshman member of Congress, I walked away frustrated because I wish there was more we could do in Washington to help deal with this hugely emerging problem.
Well, then let me pick up on that, because one of the emerging problems right now seems to be Secretary Clinton's decision to essentially waive the congressional requirement that you and your colleagues put on the last defense appropriation bill that said the $1.3 billion of military aid to the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces in Egypt could not flow unless they gave us assurances that they would protect basic freedoms. Secretary Clinton says, sorry, this is a national security emergency. We got to give them the money. Where do you think your colleagues will come down on that? Because that, of course, has immediate ramifications for those Coptic populations in Egypt.
Yeah, it's so wrong. It's so wrong on a number of levels. And I can tell you, Fred, my colleagues here in Washington, I think, are fairly upset about this. Look, one of the tools we have at our disposal in America is to use the aid, to cut off aid. It's one of the ways that we sort of speak to our principles. And if we can't defend religious freedom in Egypt, and in all the other countries over there, if we can't, A, we got to stand up for religious freedom, and then we have to back it up with certain tools. And obviously, the tool of using foreign aid or any sort of military aid, that's a powerful tool. And so to have a waiver in there, for the Secretary of State to be able to waive that, is very troubling. It takes away that tool, and it really sends such a mixed message on what we here in America stand for.
Well, I can tell you, as a former member myself, one of the frustrations I had, particularly as a freshman, was to all of a sudden learn of the kind of rules, waivers, yeah, and regulations that get in the way of public policy and determination. And I guess I would ask you, as a new member of the body and a guy who's probably bucking up against some rules himself,
right,
how do you feel about just giving a blanket waiver without any kind of congressional review whatsoever? It seems to me the secretary at the very least should come back to you guys in Congress and say, this is why we absolutely must do this, and there better be a pretty damn good explanation.
She should be called back in front of Congress, and as you say, Fred, she should have to explain why she did what she did. And then Congress has got to have the muscle and the fortitude to go right back at the administration if they're not going to change their mind on this waiver and introduce legislation. There's so much we can do, again, if you have the determination to do it. Why can't we now? Maybe we're going to be forced to put forth legislation that you can be as simple and complicated as you want, but that makes any sort of military aid contingent upon respecting basic religious freedoms in a country. What the administration's forcing us in Congress to do is to sort of, you know, raise the temperature again, and that may be what we have to do.
Well, as you know, as I'm sure already, as you've looked at budgets, every time they declare an emergency,
right,
appropriations flow, regardless of any budget resolution, and this seems to be the national security equivalent. If the secretary unilaterally says, oops, sorry, national security, Congress, then she
gets
a pass.
Well, and you're right, Fred, and we're seeing this with this administration across the board. Once the Republicans took control of the House a year ago, and this president understood that he couldn't get his way when it comes to legislation anymore, I mean, the way he's been governing by regulation and by fiat and by executive order is absolutely frightening. And he's stepping on the Constitution. But again, I would argue Congress has to fight back.
Well, then let me talk about another area that you're fighting back, in this case with Congressman Howard Berman, longtime Democrat from California. But you two have written a letter to Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, basically saying, look, what you ought to be doing is prosecuting the Palestinian terrorists who are responsible for killing and maiming Americans, the same guys that were released as part of the deal for Gilad Shalit, whom the Israelis traded for in October. What is the progress of that? Do you think you'll get any activity from the Attorney General, or do you expect him to dig in the way the Secretary of State is on national security waivers?
As of now, he appears to be digging in. He has not responded to our letter. Again, a bipartisan letter, 52 members sent it off. But there seems to be noise being made from a number of different sectors. This is, again, fairly outrageous because the administration refuses to enforce a law that's been on the books for almost 20 years. And in fact, in 2005, Congress passed the bipartisan Kobe Mandel Act, named after that 13-year-old Maryland boy who was brutally stoned to death by terrorists in Israel. There have been 71 cases of terror attacks against Americans in and around Israel since the signing of the Oslo Accords, and the Department of Justice has never indicted, extradited, or prosecuted a single Palestinian terrorist. That's, again, fairly outrageous. The letter that Congressman Berman and I sent to Holder was to bring this to his attention. As of yet, we don't have a response, but this issue's not going away.
Well, and I'm sure, even though you haven't been there for a full term yet, you're not holding your breath waiting for the Attorney General to respond. Let me turn quickly to something you're trying to do in the state of Illinois, which caught my attention, and this is really something you're talking with Governor Quinn about,
right,
which is to essentially give veterans the same kind of advantages in transitioning from military to civilian life so that they can use their, in this case, perhaps mechanical or engineering training to get a civilian job. I was not aware that for some reason they had to go to the back of the line and re-up their training when, as I'm sure you know, frequently, particularly this technical training, is better than what they'd been getting in the private sector. Why is this going on? Why are they being forced to the back of the line?
It's kind of mind-boggling, Fred. You know as well as I do, the unemployment for veterans right now well exceeds the civilian unemployment rate. And that's shameful. I'm a limited government guy. You're a limited government guy. But when it comes to men and women who've served, when they come back, we do everything for them, period. And Illinois, like too many states, basically makes them start from zero. We basically don't count in way too many industries any of their hands-on military experience when it comes to working in professions like being a mechanic, being an emergency technician, a number of areas. And so what I've asked the governor to do is sit down with me, figure out a way that we can streamline this so we can count the hands-on experience these guys have had so that they don't have to go through these cumbersome certification programs.
Well, is this
to find a job.
In the seconds we have left, is this, in your view, a union pushback? Are there trade unions that are saying they don't necessarily want to increase their ranks with qualified veterans?
I think it's a number of unions who are putting pressure on Democrat politicians to sort of keep these very cumbersome certification programs in place and not streamline the process for veterans. That's so wrong.
Well, you know, even though they're members of unions, you suppose they're still patriots, but sometimes...
Exactly, yeah.
Well, Congressman, thanks for being with us, and I hope you're not getting too frustrated yet, although it's still...
It's hard. It's hard. It's hard to get things done here.
I know, but I'm glad that you're there. I hope you stay there, and I hope you'll be back with us on Secure Freedom Radio. Congressman
Thank
Joe
you,
Walsh.
Fred.
Thank you. Frank will be back right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, parents. Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak...
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira. And like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
Following is an important message from President Clinton and President Bush.
In January, Haiti experienced an environmental catastrophe and human tragedy of epic proportion.
But thanks in part to the generous spirit of the American people, the country of Haiti has survived. But now the people need to thrive. President Clinton and I have seen firsthand the power of your contributions at work.
The Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund is on the ground, funding programs that create jobs, teach skills, and assist local businesses.
Our fund is dedicated to supporting initiatives that encourage local entrepreneurs and help build an inclusive economy that lifts up everyone.
Help us continue this work so the people of Haiti have an opportunity to prosper.
Thank you.
To donate, go to ClintonBushHaitiFund.org or text QUAKE to 20222 to give $10. Message and data rates may apply. Brought to you by the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I have really a treat in store for you. It's an opportunity for me to reconnect with a man I admire greatly and have considered a friend in the past and look forward to now being able to reconnect with a bit. Andy Nagorski is our guest, former longtime correspondent and editor for Newsweek magazine, having served in a number of very interesting posts as one of its foreign correspondents, including Berlin, Moscow twice, Warsaw, Hong Kong. He has drawn from such experiences, insights about both historical forces and those at work at present, and I'm anxious to talk with him about both. The pretext for all this is a new book that Andy has just published, one that I have not yet, I confess, had a chance to read, but I'm looking forward to on the basis of some superb reviews. It's called Hitlerland, American Eyewitness to the Nazi Rise to Power. Andy, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you, Frank. And as you say, it's wonderful to reconnect. I remember we had so many interesting conversations before, and I hope this is one of a new series.
I do as well. Let's talk a little bit about Hitlerland and kind of the insights that you've taken away from it, as I say, that I think are relevant both for those of us interested in history, but also for the kind of world we're in at the moment. But you've addressed one of the issues that seemed to me to be of endless fascination, and that is, didn't people at the time of Hitler's rise to power, and it took what, a decade or more, inexorably accreting that power and dominating Germany and then ultimately, of course, Europe. Didn't they see it coming? Didn't they understand what was in the works? Didn't they recognize this evil for what now so clearly it seems to be?
Right. I mean, that's the question. That really was my motivation for writing Hitlerland. And by the way, Hitlerland, just to explain right off the bat, was the slang term American correspondents who were in Germany in the 30s used among themselves about the country they were covering.
Right, and there are resources that you've drawn on in large part.
Right, right. And what I decided to do, I wouldn't have written a straight history of this era because there have been a lot of very interesting straight histories. Mm-hmm. But that's history in history in hindsight, and everything seems inevitable and clear. What I try to do in this book is by drawing on original diaries, memoirs, correspondence, testimonies, try to show readers how this period looked through the eyes of the Americans who were there at the time, whether they were diplomats, journalists, military attaché, famous writers like Thomas Wolfe, Sinclair Lewis, and some very famous people like who later became famous in the United States, like Howard K. Smith, the broadcaster, George Kennan. Even the young John Kennedy flits through this and say, these people, some of whom, and I track down the first two Americans who met Hitler as far back as 1922, what were their impressions? What did they figure out without knowing at that time what was going to become of him?
Yes.
And that's what I found was just fascinating to watch, and how mixed the readings were.
And give us a flavor of it, because there were some who clearly were charmed by the man, and there were others who perhaps had a better insight into what a dangerous individual he was. But by and large, was there any consensus formed at the time, or did it take shape slowly?
Well, you see, my premise was, I sort of assumed, just like you said right now, the consensus shaped slowly. But in fact, the record was even more complicated than that. The first two Americans who met Hitler in 1922 are an American diplomat by the name of Truman Smith, a young military attaché, and a Hearst correspondent by the name of Carl von Wegen. They wrote their impressions, met this local agitator, and said, wow, this guy is a marvelous demagogue. He really knows how to rouse a crowd. He might go pretty far in Bavarian politics. You know, that's a limited view, but still not bad at the time. But then once Hitler began to get some real traction, once the Depression hit, the people who meet Hitler, the most common mistake was to vastly underestimate him. He was seen as this rather, you know, strange character who went off on these rants, who was seen as very often described as effeminate and not as quote-unquote manly as the other German politicians, with these jerky motions. In fact, Dorothy Thompson, who was a very famous, most famous American woman correspondent of that era, did an interview with Hitler in 1931 in which she says, I walked into Hitler's room thinking I was meeting the future dictator of Germany, and in something less than 50 seconds, I was quite sure I was not. He was just so insignificant that there's no way this guy's going to really take power.
Wouldn't amount to anything.
And it wouldn't amount to anything. Even if he gets power, he'll be outmaneuvered by all the other smarter German politicians. That was the most common mistake.
Really? We obviously learned the hard way about his ruthlessness and his tenacity. And over time, I imagine that what you found was people began to take the measure of the man, despite how disagreeable it was. I'm very interested, if I could, Andrew, just visit with you here. There may not be an obvious Hitler figure at the moment in our own time, but I wonder whether some of the same kinds of forces that are at work today track to the kinds of things that you've chronicled in your new book, Hitlerland. Are we now witnessing in sort of the return of anti-Semitism or of an ideological force at least as powerful as fascism? Its adherents call it Sharia. But are you seeing that in some of the places that you've covered so closely? And should we be seeing it in light of what you've learned, that it's hard at the time to recognize these kinds of forces, but see it nonetheless more clearly?
Well, I would say two things about the sort of the lessons that I felt I came up with in writing Hitlerland and describing this really dark period, but sorry, that crept up on all of Europe and all of the world, was first, don't underestimate the power of an individual. Mm-hmm. The role of Hitler as the individual and why he was so underestimated but then proved so skillful in some other ways shows how someone who really represents evil can triumph for a while and create unbelievable destruction. So, the role of the individual in history is extremely important. And for instance, in Hitlerland, I talked about a situation where an American woman living in Germany may have prevented Hitler from committing suicide in 1923. Think about the staggering
irony of ironies
of that. Yeah. But the other point is, I think that while there's no easy formula, what's the next big threat, and you can't automatically apply this analogy to every situation today, I think the one lesson is, when you hear what seems like outrageous, threatening political rhetoric, you have to take it seriously. You can't just assume that because it would be suicidal and self-destructive for someone to actually carry out their threats, they won't do it.
Mm-hmm.
When you're dealing with movements and regimes, certainly like the Nazis, rational thinking isn't quite enough to give you the right equation and to figure out what the next move will be.
Yes. This is a particularly salient point at the moment when we have, for example, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff telling us that the Iranian regime is a rational regime, despite a lot of evidence that what they are about would seem, as you say, every bit as destructive, perhaps self-destructive and certainly dangerous as what Adolf Hitler laid out in Mein Kampf and then proceeded inexorably during the run-up to Hitlerland and then in the years that he was actually formally in power of exactly what you've portrayed in your new book. Again, our guest has been Andy Nagorski. He is the author most recently of Hitlerland, American Eyewitness to the Nazi Rise to Power, one of many, many extraordinary books, and needless to say, countless articles he's written in the course of his career. He is currently the Vice President and Director of Public Policy for the East-West Institute. And Andy, I hope now that we've reconnected, we'll have you back often and with many more insights like these relevant both to history and to our time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We'll talk again soon. Next up, Barry Rubin on the attacks in Toulouse, France, and what the rising danger of Sharia-adherent attacks from Hezbollah and others mean for all of us. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medications, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call. And I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened. Period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show. Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say
sweater?
That?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back and joined, as we have the privilege of being from time to time, by Dr. Barry Rubin, a professor at the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, Israel, where he directs its center known as GLORIA, the Global Research in International Affairs Center. Barry is one of our real go-to guys when it comes to matters involving the Islamist threat, both to the region and more generally. And Barry, I saw something that you had written, obviously very much in the moment, about this violent act of jihadism, as we now know it to have been, in Israel, excuse me, in France, Toulouse, France, involving some, I guess, North African French paratroopers and several innocent civilians, including three children. Tell us, now that the alleged perpetrator has met his demise, what we should make of both the immediate episode and sort of the larger story of what's happening there in Europe at the moment.
Let me begin by the theme you express better than virtually anybody, which is we have a broad, huge, decades-long issue, which is the struggle with revolutionary Islamism that seeks to want to create Sharia states.
Right. And the caliphate, for that matter.
Yeah. And we have to put stuff in the context of this, what's called a mega issue. And that's not done. So when you have an act of terrorism like this, it's cut off into a little discrete, isolated thing, as if it has nothing to do with anything else going on in the world. What are the features here? Number one, the attempt, and we're collecting this material, it's incredible, the attempt to say, this was a radical Islamist guy, self-recruited, who sympathized with Al-Qaeda. Okay. So number one, this is really a right-wing neo-Nazi, so you see all problems from the right. So they're happy, the media and academia are happy when they can put it in that box, but when it's not in that box anymore, they don't want to deal with it, so then they retreat to their second position, which is this is an isolated guy who is alienated because he's a second degree, second generation immigrant, maybe had some psychological problems. In other words, it has nothing to do with the
mega issue.
The mega issue, right. The brontosaurus in the room.
Right.
Okay. Now, but how do we need to regard, one, more obviously, is this is part of a vast struggle in which radical Islamist groups attack the West, attack Christians, attack Jews, attack the existing governments, and where possible seek to seize state power and transform society. And this is one tiny little battle incident in that big picture. Secondly of all, the perpetrators of this, not merely Al-Qaeda and all of this other groups that are doing Islamist propaganda, but Western institutions that do not want to face their responsibility. So every day we are getting anti-Israel and anti-Jewish material in the media and in academia in every country in the West, which basically tells those so inclined that is completely justified to murder Jews or Israelis because they're so horrible and demonic. Let me just take just one tiny example. It's Holland, small country considered very moderate. On the same day that the Toulouse attacks took place, there was an anti-Semitic cartoon in one of the main Dutch newspapers, which implied that Jews were paying off Geert Wilders, who is considered, you know, anti-Islamic right-wing character, so the bad person to be giving money to. This is the message. And the money is being given in by Jews. Now, this is a lie, because, in fact, there is no such money. There is no Israeli involvement. But if you were a Muslim in Holland and you see this cartoon, you say, oh, the Jews in Israel are funding our enemy, horrible anti-Islamic Wilders, and therefore they're our enemies, and therefore we should kill them. A few days earlier in the Dutch press, this is like the kind of thing you can't believe. There's actually a picture of a rocket being fired from Gaza against Israel with the caption that this is a rocket being fired from Israel into Gaza. Now, your listeners can now add on hundreds of other examples.
Yeah, almost certainly. Let me interrupt you, Barry Rubin, just to reintroduce you.
Incitement to terrorism.
Yeah, we're speaking once again with Barry Rubin of the Gloria Center in Israel. He is the author, among many books, of Muslim Brotherhood, The Global Reach of the Islamist Movement, and his latest book is Israel, An Introduction. Barry, let me just segue to another part of the mega issue, as you call it, namely Islamists in Iran, who have Israel in their crosshairs, and us as well. There was a hearing here in Washington, as you may know, yesterday in Congressman Pete King's Homeland Security Committee that had some very chilling testimony indicating that this is business of an Iranian threat is not confined to Israel or even the region. It's not an abstraction that there may be hundreds of Hezbollah operatives working for Iran as a kind of foreign legion already in the United States and prepared to engage in God only knows what kind of mayhem should they be ordered to do so. Give us your sense at the moment, if you would, Barry Rubin, as to how we stand vis-a-vis Israel and whether the president's policies, vis-a-vis Iran, whether the president's policies are conducing to war or likely to avoid it.
What the first problem here is that the weakness shown by the Obama administration, which it thinks is brilliant, or maybe it not thinks, is a brilliant thing to make friends, make everybody love America and ward off threats, is intensifying the threats by showing weakness. I mean, what was the Iranian attitude toward Obama's AIPAC speech publicly? Oh, this shows the U.S. is weakness and afraid of us and doesn't want to confront Iran. What is the effect of that on Iranian behavior? well, if they're weak and don't want to confront us, that means we should be more aggressive. And then what results from that? War becomes more likely, not less likely, because they will act in ways that will force, sooner or later, the U.S. to confront them. The same applies to other groups. My feeling, increasingly, the same applies to Egypt. I mean, the Egyptians basically try to see, don't actually, but try to seize 16 Americans as hostages, essentially, put them on trial for espionage, and somebody pays, or the Egyptians, $4 million ransom, so these people get out of the country. During this period, the U.S. basically not only goes ahead in discussion with the regular military aid, but also additional economic aid. So the seeds are being laid in the future for the Egyptian leadership to say, hey, these Americans are afraid of us. They need us more than we need them. No matter what we do, they're not going to do anything. Let's be more aggressive. And again, ends up more likely in creating a situation of conflict. This is one of the most important things in the world to understand, and I'm afraid to say that I think that the Obama administration is never going to comprehend this.
Yes. You know, it's troubling in the extreme because this is so elementary a concept. You reward a bully for their bad behavior, you get more of the bullying, and it gets almost certainly worse. Just very quickly, and we've only got a minute left, Barry Rubin, what would you counsel we do at this point about the mega issue, just in the briefest of ways? Obviously get right about what it is, but
first of all,
what else should be done?
First of all, okay, briefly, a strategic comprehension, and if it wanted to, the Obama administration or liberals or Democrats could easily do this in their own context. Islam, they could say, Islam is wonderful, Muslims are wonderful, but there's this really powerful movement, and we have to deal with this powerful movement instead of, oh, this is just marginal forces that we can buy off. So the recognition of the problem, and then in each issue, whether it be protecting the border from agents of radical Islamism crossing it, to every specific issue, you have a strategy. You pull together your allies, ranging Canada and Europe and Israel and a number of Arab governments, and you support opposition movements,
right.
And you give guns to the opposition.
You've given
in Syria.
Us some terrific ideas.
Once you understand the mega issue, the strategy falls, the specific strategic actions fall into place.
Barry Rubin, with the usual clarity and succinctness, we thank you very much for sharing these ideas with us. It's a call to arms that we must take seriously, folks. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow for more of these kinds of insights here at Secure Freedom Radio. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks to Barry Rubin. Thanks to you for listening. Over and out.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.